So tonight's my last talk in Singapore. So in preparation for the talk, we're going to do a little meditation. So really try to give it a good swing tonight. You know, just sort of like in commemoration of this being the last talk. So sit comfortably, relax your body. Sometimes it's said that when you're doing meditation, it might be worthwhile occasionally scanning through your body. You tighten the muscles at the top of the head, you let them loose, and you move down to maybe an area here by the brow or a little further down the brow around your eyes. Tighten and loosen the muscles as you go down through the body. Just relax your body, relax your mind, which is, here I mean, a preliminary relaxing to remind yourself you don't have to think about anything else right now. Even you come up with a great idea for some new product, you can attend to that later. And with a clear mind, you'll be able to attend to any of the problems that are bothering you right now. And begin by just observing your breathing, paying attention to it with your mind, especially the endpoints where the tendency might be, because the breathing has stopped and is just about to change direction, the mind can sort of wander off, multitask onto some other thoughts. Try to watch that change. As you begin trying to focus on the mind, on the breath rather, you may be still thinking about other thoughts. So try to recognize that, let go of them, and refocus that energy on watching the breathing. You really have to focus to see the endpoints because they're coming quickly. The inhalation and the exhalation have longer durations. You have to recognize that you're breathing in, recognize that you're breathing out, and recognize the change of direction. Watch it. Thank you. once you have some quiet mind from watching the breathing, follow a breath up as though it goes to the crown of your head, down to your throat, heart chakra, and leave your attention there, generally, just around your heart area, your heart chakra area. And with one part of the mind, try to observe what's happening in the rest of the mind, the clear light nature. If you've followed through these last 2 months with this meditation, you can immediately jump to just that memory of that state and then try to align that memory with your experience right now to fine-tune it. All the various thoughts that might be going through your mind, like fish in a large aquarium, or like waves on the surface of the ocean or lake. They owe their mobility, their ability to move back and forth, to the unobstructive nature of the water in the aquarium, the unobstructed nature of the mental consciousness for the thoughts to emerge from that clear light nature, dissolve back into it after some time. Remind yourself you're not paying attention to your eye consciousness, nor ear, nose, tongue, or tactile consciousness. When we were watching the breath, in a sense we were watching something connected with the tactile consciousness to begin with. But here we're just watching the mental consciousness itself. So as though being a turtle or a tortoise, withdraw your head and arms when we want to be protected into the shell. Like that, withdraw your five senses back toward your heart, just to your mental consciousness. If you get a glimpse of the spaciousness between the thoughts, or even where the thoughts are, knowing that they themselves are the same nature as the mind, even facing them but not following them, they disappear back into the mind and you're left in that state of unobstructed clarity. Luminosity. An object of wisdom, of your wisdom eye, not your physical eye. It has no shape, no color, has no boundary. when you get a sense of this clarity of the mind based on this experience, try to hold it with the magnet of mindfulness, or the glue of mindfulness. Maybe the Velcro of mindfulness. Use another faculty of consciousness, sometimes called alertness or introspection, to watch whether you are still holding onto that clarity of the mind or if you've wandered off. This is the approximation to the clear light nature of your mind, the conventional clear light nature. We say the word conventional because the ultimate nature of our mind, its emptiness, also appears as kind of a clear light. So in distinction to that, as a distinction to that, we say the conventional clear light nature. It's kind of our developmental Buddha nature. Thoughts come up to disrupt that continuity of concentration on the clear light. Let them go. Let them dissolve back into the clear light nature of the mind. Even the sense of the presence of your body, which might be one of the more prominent appearances to your mind. When thoughts like that appear, appearances like that appear, ask yourself to focus on the subjective mind to which those appearances are occurring, that's clear and knowing, that doesn't have the aspect of the appearance, that allows the appearance to be there. Sometimes you have to let go again and again and again and again. you have some success in watching this clarity of the mind, mental consciousness, inject a little fish of analysis within the pool, the calm pool of your mind. That is to say, use part of your consciousness now to recognize how your own self-identity appears to the mind by asking yourself, who's meditating? Who is it that has the great attachment for things that not yet attained? Who is it that's so concerned about criticisms or lack of respect or love? Who is it that has a slight continuum of irritation or anger? Who is it that resents being considered low or worthless? It's not the body. It's not actually just the mind. It's a sense of self. Somehow seemingly related with the body and mind. But appearing to be independent, existing on its own, from its own side, what the philosophers say, call inherently existing, an appearance of not depending on anything, not depending on being named, seems to have a real findable existence that we've always believed in since beginningless time in one incarnation or another. The appearance of this self can be found, does seem to exist and our mind reacts to that by believing, conceiving that there really is something there behind that appearance. That's the great demon. That brings about the contagious disease of self-cherishing, all of our delusions. How do we counter that grasping, that belief in that appearance of the I? Through wisdom that sees its actual nature, that understands that if such an I existed, the way the mind is believing, conceiving, as inherently existing on its own, independently, it would have to be like that, inherently truly either identical to the aggregate or truly inherently different than the aggregates, either different or identical. We know it's not inherently different than the aggregates because we, if our body is stung by a thorn or an insect, we naturally think, I have been stung. I've been injured. If it was inherently different than the body, there'd be no such identification. If such an I existed as it appears, as inherently existing, one with the aggregates, as there are five aggregates, there would have to be a sense of five selves. But there's only one sense, a unified sense of I. So those are the only two alternatives. With respect to the aggregates, those are the only two alternatives that an inherently existing I could have. It would either have to be identical to the aggregates in every way, inherently one with the aggregates, or inherently different than the aggregates. If it existed, it would have to exist that way, since it doesn't fit that criterion. It's not inherently one with the aggregates. It's not inherently different than the aggregates. Therefore, it doesn't exist. The conceived object of that ignorance that seems to be inherently existent does not exist at all. That sense of I, the boogeyman that has brought about all our problems, our sadness, our creation of negative karma. Our longing desire that's never satisfied, our anger, our jealousy, our pride, our ignorance. Almost a sense of relief, of joy, that I that I've believed in since beginningless time, that was present when I created negative actions, that was the perpetrator, the instigator of my negative actions, that never existed from the beginning. What appears to your mind when you have an instant, just a glimpse of that, is a vacuity, an emptiness, kind of like the mental apprehension we're having of the clear light nature of the mind, but here with a particular meaning implied, the mere absence of that I that we've believed in. Hold it if you can. when you lose it, analyze again. If this self did exist that I've been cherishing since beginningless time, it would have to be either identical with the aggregates, not just identical in general, but inherently identical, because it appears to be inherently existent, or it would have to be inherently different than the aggregates. It doesn't exist in either of those ways, therefore it does not exist. Like a reflection of your face is not your face, is empty of being your face. Like a mirage is empty of water. Like the echo of dogs barking is empty of actual dogs out there creating that sound. Then turn that same insight toward the mental consciousness itself, toward the clear light nature of your mind. This continuity of consciousness that has clarity and knowing as its defining factors. Its nature is clear. Its function is to know, to apprehend. This consciousness too appears to our consciousness that's trying to analyze it as inherently existing, as having some kind of pointable existence from its own side. Amazingly, this mind itself, although it appears just as the eye appears, the mind itself is also empty of inherent existence. If the clear light nature of your mind existed the way it appears, that is to say, not the clarity, the knowing, on the conventional level, that's okay, but the way it appears as existing from its own side, just like the eye appears to exist from its own side, to be inherently existent. If the consciousness existed that way, it would have to be either identical to its moments, you know, the succession of moments of the mind, would have to be inherently one with them. So there would have to be different minds each instant. Or it would have to be different than those instants of the mind. It would have to be inherently different, so that whatever those instants of mind experienced, the inherently existent mind would not experience. The eye does not exist the way it appears. It's empty. Recall that. And even the consciousness that's perceiving that, the subjective mind, the clear light nature of the mind, it too, like a mirage, like an illusion, like the reflection of the moon in a clear body of water, it appears but is empty of what seems to be there. This is the great insight that allows the Bodhisattva, the proto-Bodhisattva, to recognize I can develop good qualities. The mind is not inherently existent. Even on the conventional level, it's not one with the delusions. To think how fortunate we are to have this life of leisure and endowment that has allowed us to this evening, this afternoon, to contemplate about this. All of that was thrown by previous actions we've done in the past to create this life. I think I'm going to participate in the class tonight listening about karma, how the Buddha explained about actions and their results, so that I can have a succession of lives like this, of leisure and endowment in the future, to control my mind, to tame my mind, develop its good qualities, all the while reaching out more and more toward others, developing empathy and compassion for living beings. With that end point in mind, to achieve enlightenment for the sake of myself and others, I'm going to listen to the teachings this evening with that motivation. And then bring your attention back. Relax your body, relax your mind. Arise from your concentration. Does anyone realize emptiness? No, so you might have some insight. Any question, observation? We meditated before. When we meditated, you know, when we first began, we watched the breathing a couple of days, and then we went on to looking at the, try to find the clear light nature of the mind. We spent many days about that, and we talked about letting go of thoughts like the body and so forth, images that came to the mind. We try to recognize the appearance of the I, the object, what the logicians call the object of negation. Yeah. The I does appear, just like these outer phenomena appear. And our mind, in perceiving that appearance within our consciousness, a subtle sense of the I, not a sense of I that thinks, oh, I am a teacher, I am an artist, I am this or that, I am a doctor. But this subtle sense of I that just seems to be one's self-identity existing from its own side, that appearance is conceived by the consciousness to be really there, to have something that it really refers to. Like the person who sees a mirage and conceives that there really is water within that mirage. Or like the monk saying his mantras at night, hearing the echoes of the dogs, the one dog barking, thinking that, oh, there really are some dogs over there, and realizes at some point, there are no dogs over there. That there's sound coming, but it's empty of the creator, you know, the dog that I imagine over there. So when the mind recognizes with examples like that and through logic that the conceived object of the ignorance doesn't really exist. It just holds on to that, lets go of everything else, and just has a perception of what's called space-like meditation on emptiness. It's called space-like because when we meditate on the clear light nature of the mind, we try to let go of every other thought and just have a sense of that spaciousness. That's all that's appearing to the mind. So when one has an insight into emptiness, say the emptiness of the person, selflessness of the person, that's all that appears, just a vacuity. There's no thinking at that point. This is emptiness. It's been induced by wisdom, and as you begin to emerge from that, you recall, oh, you have an understanding that you've just realized emptiness. Not during the, if you have a thought during that apprehension of the space-like experience, if you think, oh, this is emptiness, that's sort of moving away from what you want to try to achieve. You want to try to have only an apprehension of this vacuity. Once you have that experience of having an idea what that means and see if that has an impact on your behavior, you know, all of these actions that we're talking about, we'll talk about tonight, karma, negative actions that we've created, positive actions we could create and may have created, there was never a real self the way that we thought when we created those actions, you know, defending ourselves, feeling powerful, feeling the need to express our anger or our frustration. There never was such a self. That itself is, that understanding is a great purification of negative karma, as you understand that. Then to apply that understanding to the consciousness itself, emptiness. The same logic that you use in establishing the emptiness of the person can be used to establish the emptiness of the consciousness itself. Here we're using not any of the consciousnesses, not the I, we're using the mental consciousness that we have refined and have, many of the disturbing thoughts have been diminished, if not reduced. Diminished. So it's very quiet and it has a space-like quality, so it's a very good laboratory to do this experiment in. You try to sense how that appearance of the mind, the clear-light nature of the mind, still has a similar kind of inherent sense to it, to our consciousness, as though it has an existence there without doubt. It's not something that's merely labeled, you know, like an empty, you know, like a cinema that you watch, movie that you watch, that's actually devoid of the reality that some people in the audience are attributing to it, you know, crying or, you know, getting excited or whatever. It really seems to be something really there, real consciousness back there. So recognizing that in the same way, using the same logic that you apply to the self and other logics, there are many, many reasons, many, many ways of analyzing to convince oneself, to prove that the inherent existence cannot exist. It's a well-spoken fact in Buddhism. The Dalai Lama has mentioned many times that when you have, if you have an insight into emptiness, that's incredibly powerful. It can shake the foundations of samsara. Even to have a doubt about it can shake the foundations of samsara. But to apply that to the mind itself, the consciousness, His Holiness has said that can lead to very rapid spiritual progress. So if you have found some sense of these meditations we've been doing, please continue, you know, in your meditation all the time, you know, at your job, hopefully not when you're driving, you know, you should concentrate, but at other times, if you're at your desk, your manager might think, you know, you're spacing out for a minute, but you'll be meditating on emptiness, you know. You can go back to that again and again, especially when something, you know, disturbing happens. You know, it can be a way to, that's your ultimate refuge. Remember when we talk about refuge, in Buddhism we talk about the three objects of refuge, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Of those, for us right now, the actual refuge is the Dharma. In a sense, the ultimate refuge is the Buddha, in the sense of your ultimate achievement of Buddhahood. So you might say, even here, when you say the Dharma refuge, what is the actual Dharma? True cessations and the path that leads to true cessations. What's the path that leads to the true cessation of the delusions? Meditation on emptiness. So this is meditation on the emptiness of your mind is like your ultimate refuge. It's also analogous to your Buddha nature. So it's like taking refuge in your resultant Buddhahood also. Okay, enough of that. Any questions before we go on?
What jolts me back again is like remembering or memory. And when I remember, then that appears like this. The thought then starts to concretize or crystallize this inherently existing self. But where does that thought or that memory, where does that come from?
I like that remembering. So you remember and then you remember.
So, but I just wonder where the source of that, where does it come from?
Well, even when we're trying to watch one object, like the clear light nature of the mind, thoughts arise out of the mind because of karma, because of feeding them, because of our familiarity with them. As you become familiar with a state that doesn't grasp at thoughts, you don't give them energy, and they begin to subside, the frequency. I remember this. I remember. There's a scene in so many of the 1930 movies, and it was sort of very... patriarchal, male-oriented, sort of like the woman is the, you know, the one who's unstable or something. So the woman is saying something and she's becoming very incoherent, and the guy slaps her across the face. She says, "Thank you, I needed that." As though, so our slap across our face is remembering we don't have to follow these thoughts. So learning that if you keep on a train of thought, you perpetuate it. Even if you stop paying attention to it, it may arise again because of just recent familiarity with it. But as you let go again and again, it begins to subside in how often it arises and maybe diminishes. So it's a matter of familiarity, watching watching any one object. Right now, we don't yet have perfect concentration. Ideally, that would be achieved first. Use the clear light nature of your mind to try to develop, if not shamatha, if not calm abiding, what else is tranquil abiding, something much more quiet and and stable in our present state of mind, and then within that to begin to investigate the I, how the I appears, how the mind reacts to it. All the time, if one remembers, you know, if one gets to the point where one has some conclusion like emptiness, a sense of the emptiness of the I, it may not last very long. You might just have an insight in that. But the same as when we watch the clear light nature of the mind. At first we had a glimpse, and then some other thought came to disturb that. And then we had to go back, let go of those thoughts, and recalibrate and refine the object. There's an expression I might have mentioned once before in the course, in these series of talks. There is work of this lifetime. I always think in the morning when after I shaved the day before, you know, I have to shave again, you know, or maybe 2 days. In retreat, I let it go for some time, but it's like that's a work that's never finished. You know, if you feel right now, I just shaved earlier, just an hour or so ago. Is it already growing? I don't know. So, the works of this lifetime: finding friends, finding resources, finding comfort, housing, all of it. Every life we have to do again and again. That's a work that's never finished while we're in samsara. So it's much better to do, even though it seems more arduous to practice the Dharma, to concentrate, to try to recognize emptiness, that's the work that has an end. When you realize emptiness, all of the delusions will begin to cease as you continue to meditate on emptiness through the various stages. So that's the good work. That's the work that has an end. So if you think in your own mind, what do I want to do? Just always again and again, life after life, have to, you know, go through the same traumas of this lifetime. In some lives, they'll be much worse than now. Right now, you're all Singapore citizens, I think. Most of you are Singapore citizens. You have healthy bodies and minds, are intelligent, are educated. You have enough resources. Even if you'd like to have more, you have enough. But in future lives, you know, in other realms, in other situations, you won't have. Even now, it's difficult to meditate, right? How many of you can find time to really do this? So think, make strong aspirations. This is what I want to do. So when you have a glimpse of something, don't be surprised that it won't last long, because we have to. All of these other factors, karma is still ripening and so forth, thoughts are coming. So just be patient. Again, go back to that. Let go of those thoughts and see if you can recall what you were just experiencing, the emptiness. If you can't recall it, if it's unclear, sort of the meaning, if it's just a vague sense of empty, again, go through the logic. You know, let's say the self, if the self existed the way it appears, it would have to be either inherently identical with the aggregates or inherently different from the aggregates. That's just one particular reasoning. And you remember the reason for that. If any two things exist, say my glass case and this cup, they either have to be identical or different. In this case, these two things are different, right? But here, when we talk about this self, There's a different factor. One of the two things you use is the self and the aggregates, because the aggregates are associated with the self. But here, the sense of this I that we're investigating is one in which it seems to be truly there, inherently there from its own side. So this particular statement that the self and the aggregates would have to be in one or different, you have to add the word inherently one or inherently different. That makes a big difference. That's why the logical consequences of that. If it was inherently different, it would have nothing to do with the aggregates at all. If it was inherently one with the aggregates, it would have to be one with them in every way. There would have to be five selves, which we don't experience. So you can come to conclusion through that, very briefly, that that I doesn't exist. You might have to use that logic again and again when it becomes unclear. Hard work, but that's the work that can be done. Okay, so let me continue a little bit more about karma. We talked about, remember we said the supramundane view of reality, according to Buddha, the transcendent view of reality is the view of emptiness. Remember? What we say, right view. The mundane correct view, or right view, is the right understanding of karma and its effects. Karma means action, right? Our actions create repercussions later, just like the Newton's, was it second law of motion? I always forget. Third law of motion. Right? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Thanks. See if I can remember that now. Newton's third law of motion. So on the psychic level, on the experiential level of sentient beings, our actions also have equal and opposite reactions. We talked about that. If you create good, you'll have some, not immediately, but at some point you'll have some reaction that comes back that is experienced as pleasant. If you create negative actions out of your ego, you'll have repercussions that are unpleasant. This is the Buddha's, not just the Buddha's teaching, even the Vedic teachings that preceded him in India. This was commonly accepted. Even Christ said, and I believe somehow inherent in Christian teachings, he is said to have mentioned in his teachings, ye reap what ye sow. That's the old sort of biblical language that I remember hearing. Basically, if you translate it into modern language, you will have a harvest of whatever seeds you distribute, you sow. So if you sow bad seeds, you're going to have a bad crop, right? Makes sense. So we talked about that. We talked about the general qualities of karma, the four noble truths of karma. So, what is it? Karma is definite. Means that if you create virtuous actions, they will definitely only bring something that's pleasant as their result. You'll never experience an unpleasant result from good actions. Sometimes you might doubt that. You do good actions and then someone criticizes you or disdains you or ignores you. And you might think, good actions don't have good results. What's happening there? You've sown seeds for your own future happiness. Might ripen this lifetime, maybe many lifetimes in the future. What you're experiencing now, this bad reaction from someone else that might be uncomfortable, is the result of negative actions you created in the past. Of course, when you are kind now and you do good, oftentimes people are receptive. They like you, they love you, they're patient with you, and you have friends. But we do have experiences when we do good and we have doubt about the law of karma because we say, I've done good and bad, I've gotten bad back. So you have to recognize that karma is definite. Negative actions will definitely never ripen in anything pleasant. So you want to try to avoid negative actions and to create virtuous actions. Karma's second noble truth, not noble truth, it's my joke, of karma. Karma is expandable. That when we created some action, whether you think of the analogy of a seed being laid on our consciousness or you just think of that action the end of the action still having repercussions, being a not the, the very ceasing of the action have it being a compounded phenomena, something that will have results in the future, however you think of it. Just use the analogy now as a seed. The seed, it's not as though the seed begins to sprout in your consciousness, but the seed over time expands in its potency. So even a small action, virtuous or non-virtuous, will grow in potency. At the time of death, what the karma that's about to ripen that will throw you into your next lifetime depends on two things. Depends on the craving and grasping at that time, and it depends on what karma is most potent, strongest, biggest at that time in your consciousness. So oftentimes it's karma you've created in lifetimes in the past that has become more and more potent. Lifetime you've created, karma you've created this lifetime maybe hasn't reached that level of potency, so it may not ripen unless it's incredibly powerful, like something done with great fervor and devotion and faith and wisdom, you know, bodhicitta motivation, guru devotion. Some karma like that might be incredibly powerful and even more powerful than these other karmic seeds in your consciousness. So knowing that karma is expandable, increasing, you want to avoid even small negative actions and create even small virtues if you get the chance, even, you know, rather than just ignoring it, if you have a chance to create some virtue, to create even small virtues, because they will have big results in the future. Third, there's no way to experience a result unless you created the cause. Like the example we gave in, when we talked about patience, the antidotes to patience, the arrow and the target. If we didn't shoot the arrow in the past life, even if there was a target this lifetime, some cooperative condition, car accident, plane crash, whatever, we wouldn't experience, if we didn't create the karma, we wouldn't experience the result. You know, say some damaging result. And then it has many applications. If we want to experience happiness in the future, if we want to be loved, if we want to be respected, if we want to be have enough resources, we have to create the causes for that. We can't experience something, any result, unless we create the cause for it. And we can't experience the result of other people's karma. You can't just transfer karma from one person to another. I mean, in one of our talks, I'm not sure if that lady had come back again. She had mentioned how I'm not sure if it's Theravada or Chinese Mahayana teachings that she'd received. It was very common to at the end of the meditation practice to transfer your merits to others. That's what she used. That's the word that was often used. But over the years, as we checked it, this is not in general, this is not a Buddhist concept. You can't transfer your merits to others. You can dedicate your merits. Maybe that's the word that was mistranslated in a sense as transferring. But your karma will only ripen on you. So if you dedicate your merits for others, this is different than talking about prayers for others. But if you dedicate your merits for others, that means that when that karma ripens on you, there will be some karmic connection with others that you will be beneficial for them. Say, for instance, if you were to have wealth, you will want to give to them, those people that you dedicate to sentient beings. So karma is definite, expandable. There's no way to experience a result without creating a cause. And karma never perishes. It doesn't have an expiration date on it. You know, the potent seeds, you know, you might think, oh yeah, oh, those seeds, those pods of karma in my mind stream that are getting more and more potent. But it's been 30 years since I created that karma. It's probably now rotten. You know, it's not, you know, like the seeds in that you buy in the store. It says use before 2000. 14, you say, oh my gosh, 5 years old. You know, you plant those, they might, something might grow out of, you throw 100 seeds down, maybe one or two will grow because they're not rotten, may not be the right word. They've lost their potency. Karma is not that way. It doesn't perish. We talked about that. We talked about so when you take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, once you taking refuge, main refuge is the Dharma. And what is the commitment of that refuge? You know, if you're trying to practice the Dharma, that's your real refuge. What's the main thing you have to do at the beginning? What's the first initial way? You have to observe, guard your actions, guard karma. We sometimes say observe your karma. It doesn't mean like just watching, oh, I'm killing, I'm stealing, It means observing, of course, observing that, but preventing the creation of negative karma and going out of your way to create virtuous karma. That's what's meant by observing karma. So we went over some of the factors involved in karma and paths of karma, paths of action, actions and paths of action. So we'll explain a little bit more about the differentiation between the word karma and path of karma, action and path of karma in a couple of minutes. But first, we talked a little bit about, say, killing. There's certain, first of all, there have for a path of action to be complete. Path of action, in a sense, means if you've had the original intention to do something, you've carried it out, you've completed it, all of the different factors there that can bring very strong karmic results in the future. If some of those factors are missing, the action will not necessarily, for instance, be strong enough to throw you into another rebirth. So if you are impelled to do some negative action, if you can avoid having the completion of the action or the rejoicing about it or other factors, if you can prevent those, at least, even if you create negative karma, it won't be strong enough to throw you into a lower rebirth or have very heavy negative karmas, heavy results. So we talked about the basis. What were the other ones? The thought, the action, and the completion of the action, right? For killing. Here I want to, and we talked about also for stealing. We talked a little bit. I'm going to jump over some of those. Just go to jump to one of the heaviest verbal actions, the action of slander or divisive speech. Divisive speech doesn't mean, okay, you people go to that side, you people go to that, you're dividing like that. It means, let's say, the basis of slander is twofold. People who are harmonious, either two or more people that are harmonious, groups of people that are harmonious with each other, or those who are unfriendly or not on good terms. Doesn't matter. You just have two groups of people. The thought is to separate them. The motivation, let's say, among the thought, there's various parts. The motivation is to, for some reason, maybe, coming out of some delusion in your own mind, wanting them to separate. Maybe they're too friendly with one another, so you want one person's friendship. They're friendly with someone else, so you try to divide them. Or for political reasons, you try to divide the opposition party. This is happening in American politics right now. The Democrats, the Republicans are trying to divide the various Democratic candidates, and Democrats are doing the same thing, of course. So you have to have a discrimination, first of all. The discrimination and the obscuring affliction are the same as in lie is for lying. That is to say, the obscuring affliction is any of the three poisons, You know what the three poisons are? Arsenic. No, three poisons. Here we're talking about the three poisonous minds, right? Three poisonous minds are ignorance, what? Attachment, hatred, right? So you can say divisive words out of ignorance, not knowing that it's bad, still, so forth, or out of attachment, out of hatred. The perception should be unmistaken, that is to say, or the discrimination should be unmistaken. If the people are friendly, you should perceive that they are friendly, and you want to discriminate, you want them to separate. If they're not friendly, you should perceive that. The direct motivation is to foster division between the people who are harmonious or non-harmonious, or increase the division between those who are unharmonious. When you use speech to sow that discord and damage the relationship between the people, that is this divisive speech or slander. So the reason I picked this one out of the 10 paths to jump to, we skipped over sexual misconduct, lying, because of the various negative actions. This is perhaps can be the most heavy. Why is that? Do you know? What kind of divisive speech can you create that's very heavy? Do you know? Have you heard? Of the five actions of immediate retribution, sometimes translated as the five heinous. Is it heinous or heinous crimes? Is the right pronunciation? I don't know if I should depend on Singaporean pronunciation. Is it heinous or heinous? Heinous, okay. That's just a generic translation. The literal translation is the five actions of immediate retribution. It means if you create some of these actions in the very next lifetime without any intermediate life, you immediately have the result. They're so heavy. One of them is in the time of the Buddha to cause division within the Buddha's disciples, the Sangha. You know, because that was at the time of the Buddha, all the future of the Dharma for that dispensation of the Dharma in a world system that depends on the harmony of the monastic community and how the lay community views the monastic community. So that's one of the greatest negative kinds of karma you can create. That's what Devadatta and Ajata Shastru also created in the time of the Buddha. So the action of slander is to make statements in order to create the discord and division. Can be pleasant or can be unpleasant words, but when the people understand that, that's the action. The culmination of the action is when those you wish to divide understand what you say, according to one of the great Asanga's interpretation. Asanga, remember, was this one of the two brothers, Vasubandhu and Asanga. He was the Mahayana proponent from the beginning. Some others say that the action is complete when it actually causes a division. But according to Asanga, just when they understand what you say, even if it doesn't cause division, that's considered to be divisive speech. So just even you uttering those words and they understand what you say, even they say, "What are you talking about?" And they don't separate. Still, that's considered very technically to be divisive speech. That's the completion of the action. Okay, I want to go to one other one of the actions of mind, the paths of action of mind. What are they? Covetousness, malice, and wrong view. So I want to go to wrong view. Okay, so. What is when we talk about wrong view, anyone have an idea what wrong view is? When we talk about the 10 non-virtuous actions or the 10 paths of non-virtue, Do you know, Cece? Or I should ask. Wrong view of true existence and what? Well, when we say wrong view in general, if we don't talk about 10 virtuous, non-virtuous actions, many kinds of wrong view. You can have a wrong view about things that do exist, like rebirth and karma, the achievement of nirvana and Buddhahood and so forth. You can believe that they don't exist wrongly, or you can believe that things that don't exist do exist. You can superimpose some kind of existence upon things that they don't have. Say, for instance, superimposing true existence or inherent existence. Here, though, so one of them is a deprecation, wrong view in general, when you talk about wrong views in general, or one of them is a, what's the opposite of deprecation, when you superimpose something? Denigration, when you refute something that's really there, even partially, and another is when you superimpose qualities that are not really there. Those are both kinds of wrong views. But here, in the paths of action, the 10 non-virtuous actions, the objects of wrong view must be something that actually exists. So this is going to be, this is the more at the beginning, this is the most detrimental. Of course, all non-virtuous thoughts can be a form of wrong view. I'm reading from Geshe Zopa's book here on his commentary on Lanrim Chamo, Volume 2. As I mentioned before, this was around page 68, if you have that book. Of course, all non-virtuous thoughts can be a form of wrong view, but here, among the three mental non-virtues, wrong view means a nihilistic view. Therefore, the object with respect to which this view is wrong must be something that is real, that exists, and the wrong thing is to deny the existence of that object. So, say for instance, you might think that grasping to true existence is a wrong view, right? But that's not this one. You might think, yeah, like it. You're surprised, huh? This one is talking about the fundamental things at the beginning that prevent you from entering into the path. This refers to such objects as karma, the law of cause and effect, liberation, samsara, the Four Noble Truths, the achievement of nirvana, and so forth, achievement and enlightenment, things that do exist. If you hold the view that they don't exist, this is something that can prevent you from entering into the path. So technically, grasping to true existence is kind of a wrong view also, but it's not something from the very beginning that is preventing you in the same way that this nihilistic view is. Wrong view is to deny these things which in fact do exist. So that's the basis. Remember we talked about the basis, the thought, the actual action, and the completion of the action. So the thought of wrong view had several parts. The discrimination is to believe that it is okay, it's correct to deny things that actually exist. That doesn't mean that you know that they exist and that you deny it. It's just you think it's okay to deny these things. The affliction, there's discrimination, affliction, and the motivation. So the affliction is any of the three poisonous minds. The motivation is wanting to deny the existence of that object. You know, seems logical. Why would one deny things like karma, rebirth? Oh, a lot of people, there's no evidence for them, the existence of these things. They're sometimes hidden or deeply hidden phenomena. So because there's no evidence and someone doesn't see a reason for belief in them. So one might not just have an open mind. One might like think, I'm a scientist. Scientists do not believe in ghosts. You know, you ever hear that on TV programs? You know, oh, you know, psychic phenomena don't exist. There's no scientific proof. So you might, for various reasons like that, involved with your own ego and so forth, have a very strong reason to hold that these things do not exist. That's the thought. The action is to engage in that wrong view. This involves the process of contemplating and progressively cultivating that kind of thought until you actually hold that wrong view. You know, as a kid, maybe thinking, oh, yeah, people are talking about actions having results. You know, the Bible class said, ye reap what ye sow. I don't know. Later, as you think about it more and more, you have your own reasons contemplating it in a wrong way, and to eventually come to a very strong conclusion, karma doesn't exist, rebirth doesn't exist. I've mentioned before, in the Christian church, originally, up until, I think, the second century after Christ, there was still a belief in reincarnation that was outlawed by the second convocation, I think, in Constantinople, something like that. You can check. Maybe that's almost like institutionalizing wrong view from a Buddhist perception, Buddhist point of view. Wrong view is generally divided into four types: the denial of cause, result, agency, and existent object. Well, you can read about this. I won't go into the detail about that. The reason for mentioning about wrong view is that among the negative actions, these 10 actions that the Buddha pointed out, remember, 3 actions of body, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, 4 actions of speech, lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, idle gossip, and 3 actions of mind, covetousness, malice, and wrong view. These were pointed out by the Buddha as an initial way. If you want to observe karma, you want to guard your actions, these are the main things to guard. There are many other negative actions, but this is a good first approximation. Just like when the Buddha talked about the 6 realms. What are the 6 realms, you know? The hell realms, the Preta realm, the animal realm, so-called lower realms, the human realm, the asura, the demigods, and the deva realm. Right? And then among the devas, there's desire realm, form, and formless. So I think that's also an approximation. It's just a first, because there's some kind of beings, it's hard to say where they are, like certain kinds of spirits. They're not pretas, they're not animals. So nagas are generally associated within the animal realm, right? Generally, although that's because they sometimes manifest as serpents or something that seem to be animals. But sometimes I think some other kinds of spirits that, you know, it's hard to say where they are in these realms. It might be these 6 realms might be like these 10 non-virtuous actions. A general first, you know, general approximation. There might be other kinds of things in between, in between the corners there. So, at the end of the action, the culmination of the action of wrong view is when you definitely decide that this is the true nature of things. You cultivate this attitude of mind until you definitely believe and say these things do not exist. When you make that definite determination that that's the way things are, that's the culmination of the karma of wrong view. Okay. So I won't go into more detail about that. So there's another point to talk about this, about karma. It's sort of interesting detail. The concluding motivation. So Geshe-la says, in the preceding analysis of the 10 karmic paths, remember we talked about paths of action, we've discussed which obscuring afflictions act as the initial or distant motivation for these actions. So before you enter into the action, you might be motivated by attachment or anger or ignorance or jealousy, any of the delusions. That's the initial motivation. We saw that all of these negative actions can be initially motivated by any of the three root obscuring afflictions. Now we look at what kind of thought is motivating the action during its concluding stage. What kind of motivation is active once the action is underway and is brought to conclusion? I wonder if you've ever heard this before. So for the non-virtue of killing, the non-virtuous actions of killing, harsh speech, and malice, that's the one from each of the, there's a body, killing, harsh speech among speech, and malice among the actions of mind. The initial motivation can be any of the three poisons, but the concluding motivation is also always hatred, anger. So for instance, in killing, even though you might have been motivated initially by ignorance, not knowing that it's wrong, thinking that you're actually good, you're offering to Shiva or some god or spirit, or there's nothing wrong, you know, killing the cockroaches or the rats or something, killing animals. At the end, when you're actually completing the action, shooting, killing, smashing, whatever it is, cutting the head off of the animal, there has to be an instant of malice there. So that you may remember when we talk about the bodhisattvas are enjoined, for the benefit of sentient beings, you should be willing, out of compassion for sentient beings, you should be willing to engage in the seven actions, negative actions of body and speech, knowing that there'll be repercussions on you, with the motivation of bodhicitta, you know, thinking, even I have to experience the repercussion of lying, saying, oh no, George went out the door when the police come looking for George, you know. Knowing that that's a lie and that one might have some repercussions. But there's a debate about killing. One of the great stories of the Buddha when he was a merchant on a ship, and he knew that there was one man that wanted to scuttle the ship, wanted to cause everyone on the ship to die. You know the story? And we mentioned that out of bodhicitta motivation, he tried everything to dissuade this person. The only way that he could stop him in the end is to kill him. So the question, if you analyze it philosophically, okay, again, this is sort of like, maybe sounds like nitpicking, but did he create negative karma? Some people say he didn't create any negative karma at all because he had this bodhicitta motivation. Others say, and just as validly, because at the moment of killing, even though the motivation up till then is positive, bodhicitta motivation, in order to kill, there has to be the final moment of some kind of thought of severing the life stream of someone. That's what's being talked about here. I said, killing, harsh speech, and malice, the initial motivation may be any of the three poisons, or for bodhisattva, it might be bodhicitta, but the concluding motivation is hatred, anger. This means that once the action is begun, the intention is to hurt, harm, or destroy. This harming thought is always the motivation at the conclusion of those three actions. For example, when you kill an animal, it may be out of desire for meat, but once you undertake the action, the motivation is the intention to do harm. It is the, you know, to sever the life force of that being, to kill it. Okay. The concluding motivation of those three, what was it? Killing, harsh speech, and malice all end with a hatred. For stealing, sexual misconduct, and covetousness, again, one from each of the stealing and sexual misconduct, both from body, covetousness, from mind. The initial motivation can be any of the three poisons, but they are always brought to completion by what? Desire, attachment. We can imagine stealing from others because you hate them, or stealing something because you believe you have the right to take it, but at the concluding stage of the action, the intention is always to take the object away. This is a form of desire. So stealing is completed when you think, ah, I got it. It's mine. Same thing for sexual misconduct. You might start out with maybe, how could you do it out of ignorance or hatred? Say, raping, pillaging. How could you do it, out of any of these actions, out of any of the three poisonous minds? But at the end, there's always attachment in experiencing that desirous pleasure. Okay, so another set for lying, slander, and meaningless speech. Lying, slander, so divisive, lying, divisive speech, and what's the word we use? Senseless speech, meaningless speech. Both the initiating motivation and the concluding thought can be any of the three poisons. But for wrong view, the initiating motivation can be any of the three poisons, but the concluding thought is always wrong view itself. Okay. Do you follow? You're spacing out. Yeah, you're looking at me, but you're not. Okay. What does that mean? Wrong view. The final concluding motivation is not covetousness, is not ignorance, hatred, or attachment. It's wrong view itself. So Geshe-la says, we will try to clarify the difference between karma and karmic paths. So in this relationship. So what's the difference between karma and path of karma, action and path of action? I gave a general meaning before. Action means, in general, is there a difference between affliction, say klesha, and karma? Can they be the same? Is there anything which is a klesha and a karma? Like when we talked about the 12 links, remember we said the first link, ignorance and craving and grasping, were all klesha, they were afflictions. And the second link and becoming, what was that, the 10th link or something, are karmas. So generally, klesha and karma are different. Which causes which? When we talk about the cause of suffering, remember the truth of the cause of suffering? Two causes, klesha and karma. You know these words I'm saying? No, this girl with the green shirt. Do you know the words I'm saying? Okay. So klesha, maybe I was thinking people might recognize that. That's an Indian word that refers to delusions like hatred and anger, all that big set of things. Karma means action. So when the Buddha explained the cause for all our suffering in cyclic existence, he said the immediate cause was karma, the ripening of actions that we did, like the seeds in our consciousness that give rise. That's the main substantial cause of our suffering. But how did that karma get created? Because there was some affliction or klesha in our mind, like anger or attachment, that was moved, our mind was kind of moved, scratched, left some impression in our consciousness. So karma and klesha are generally different. So to clarify between karma and karmic paths, these are terms that appear in the sutras and in the Abhidharma literature, these two things, karma and karmic paths. So it's useful to know the difference. So in Lamrim Chemo, Lama Tsongkhapa made the distinction between them here. Karma is intention. right? The mental factor, intention. Is intention a klesha? Who said it? Is it? I can't remember the names. Violet, you know, Rachel. Is in the mental factors, you're studying, you're going to take exams soon, and mind and mental factors. So, intent, the mental factor, intention, is that a klesha? Is that a delusion? What is it? It's one of the five omnipresent mental factors, ever-present mental factors, right? It's not a delusion. But it moves the mind, and if there is a klesha in the mind, the movement of the mind with the klesha there creates the karma. So we say that karma is intention, and also what's motivated by the intention. Intention is a mental activity, right? The movement of the mind, thinking this or that. Karma is also what's motivated by that through speech, you know, lying, slander, abuse, and so forth, and bodily actions that are motivated by intention. For example, the karma of killing, okay, the karma of killing is the intention to take another's life. Remember when we talked about the basis, the thought, the action, the completion of the action. The thought included intention. What was your intent? The recognition of the object, and what delusion was there? So the intention, killing is actually the intention to kill. That's the action of killing. Does that make sense? The intention to kill. That's the karma of killing. What's the path of karma of killing? It's the whole sequence from the intention, you know, with the object, finding the object, having the correct object, doing the action, completing the action. That's called the path of action. So in killing, and for the seven objects seven actions of body and speech, of the ten non-virtues, seven are of body and speech, right? Those are the ones that we have some control over. Actions of mind are more subtle. So the seven actions of body and speech have both, you know, the karma and paths of karma. Let's explain. If the intention to kill is not present, you will not create the actual karma of killing, right? Because intention is the actual karma. If you don't have the intention, you step on an insect accidentally, you don't create the karma of killing. Also, you don't create the path of karma depends on all of those elements. You don't have the path of karma of killing either. Karma is mainly internal. It is a mental act, wanting or intending to kill. In Buddhist psychology, intention is a mental factor that is present at all times. It's an omnipresent mental factor. Okay. So that's what karma means, intention, in any of those actions. The path of karma means either the cause of an intention or its object. In other words, its actualization. The seven non-virtues of body and speech are karma because they are the intention to commit an action. For example, killing. They are also karmic paths, those seven, because they are also the object of that intention. So the intention, let's say, of killing is the action of killing, you know, wanting to kill. How is that brought about? By doing the action, completing the action, right? So the seven actions of body and speech are both karmas and paths of karma. Whoa. a little bit, you have to think about this. So the seven non-virtues of body and speech are both karma and karmic paths, both the intention and the object or actualization of that intention. The three mental karmas, however, covetousness, malice, and wrong view, are only karmic paths. They are not karma. Why is that? Karma means what? Intention. So killing, actual karma of killing, is the intention to kill. Stealing, the action of stealing, is the intention to steal. The karmic path of stealing is when that intention is brought to its completion through doing the action, completing the action. The action of sexual misconduct is the intention to engage in misconduct. The action of lying is the intention to lie, and so forth. But the mental karmas, covetous, malice, and wrong view, are only karmic paths. They are not karma. They are not intention. So covetousness is not the intention to create karma. To create covetousness. They are karmic paths because they are the cause of the source from which an intention arises. Malice, for example, is not itself an intention, but is the underlying cause from which an intention arises. So unlike the seven objects, seven actions of body and speech, which they themselves are intention, they are karma. The three karmas, karmic actions, mental karmas, covetousness, malice, and wrong view, are only paths of action, because malice creates the intention to do it, covetousness creates the intention to get what you want, wrong view creates the intention to hold that wrong view. This distinction is drawn a little more clearly in the Abhidharma system in Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha, Treasury of Knowledge, where it is made in terms of karma and obscuring afflictions, karma and klesha. Karma and klesha are mutually exclusive. If something is an action, it's not. It's not what? It's not a klesha. If it's a klesha, it's not a karma. Remember when we said the truth of suffering and the truth of the cause of suffering. The truth of the cause of suffering is twofold, karma and klesha. Actions and the motivating factor that created those actions, which were afflictions, kleshas. So there's two different things. They're mutually exclusive. Something can't be both. The three non-virtues of mind are afflictions, but they are not karma. Unlike the first seven. So this gives you some of the other things we were talking about. I said, Geshe Zopa used to say when we were studying philosophy, he said, now we're going to be chewing dry bones, you know, sort of very... Not a lot of taste. But this is a little more, this is like a bone that's got some gristle on it and a little bit of marrow you can suck on. You can understand this one. Analyze the difference between the first seven of these so-called non-virtuous actions, the actions of body and speech. Each one of them is karma. It is killing is the intention to kill. You know, lying is the intention to lie. But they are also, for their completion, they are paths of action. They have the whole heavy karma of killing or stealing or sexual misconduct and so forth. You have to have that path of action. Whereas the three non-virtues of mind are afflictions, but they are not karma. So they are paths of karma. There's a, you know, through covetousness, you have the intention to get something that doesn't belong to you, and you carry that out, and so forth. Okay. So there's so much that could be talked about karma. I would really recommend to you, if you have the interest to practice the Dharma, to study, maybe go over Geshe, Ken Rinpoche's Geshe, what's our teacher's name? Geshe Chunin. Ken Rinpoche's teachings, if he has a transcript of that, or this text by Geshe Sopa, which was a commentary on the Lanrim Chemo, going over all these details. So many other things to know. I wanted to leave some time in case, since this is the last talk, in case there's some questions you've stored in your mind, you never get a chance to ask, so you'll be number one, okay?
Remember, you mentioned in the previous lecture that you are going to tell us about how to mitigate those negative karma that we have created.
How to purify those negative karmas? Okay, so I have to do that. So we'll give you the short version because this is something you should know and you should be able to find in a lot of the teachings. Is something that's taught very often. The unskillful person that creates negative karma is like doubly bad for them because they don't realize that karma can be purified. In fact, they don't realize that, for instance, in rejoicing in that negative action, they're even making it worse. How can you purify actions that you've done? The Dharma practitioner, all of us, we as Lama Yeshe, I remember Lama Yeshe saying sometime when we would inadvertently criticize someone else, and he said, "They means well, dear." They means well. They means well. So we mean well. We means well. But our delusions get the best of us sometimes. We say harsh words. Maybe a big period of our life we get caught up in some particular emotional trip, you know, attachment for friends or hatred for something or maybe avarice, wanting to get things. So we create negative karma. Then we get to come to our senses and we say, what? Oh, that karma I did, I created. How can I purify it? So the Buddha taught there are four powerful forces that if applied in unison, again and again, can purify any negative karma. Any negative karma that we created can be purified through application of the four opponent forces. Even the actions of immediate retribution, breaking the vows of pratimoksha vows, you know, your lay vows or the vows of a monk or nun or the bodhisattva vows, tantric vows, all can be purified through application of the four opponent forces. What are they? The main one, I'll give in terms of what most efficacious, regret or remorse. That doesn't mean guilt. You know, you might think it means, oh, you got to feel guilty about it. I did that. I'm a bad guy or girl. It means having a wisdom consciousness that knows that the action you created is going to have negative consequences on your mind stream, on your continuum, not necessarily on your mind, on your body and speech, also somewhere in life, and feeling, oh, that's wrong. You know, that's bad. I've created that to feel regret about what you did. I shouldn't have done that. That's an example of regret. Regret is a powerful way to purify negative karma. Also, regret acts to nullify positive karma too. If you've created something good and later you regret having done that, you wasted your time. Oh, I spent all those years making prostrations and study, a waste of time. I could have been making money. You know, that can actually diminish the power of the virtue you create. So you want to apply regret toward the negative actions you've created again and again. And later, your motivation for regret can become more Mahayana, more Mahayanist, in the sense of not just that it's that negative karma is going to ripen on your continuum in something that's unpleasant, so I shouldn't have done it, but this negative karma I created is an obstacle to my making realizations of the path. It's preventing me from achieving liberation. Later, with a Mahayana point of view, this karmic, these negative actions I created are obstacles to my generating bodhicitta and love and compassion for others. And even in the future, when they ripen, they will prevent me from really helping others. I'll be born poor, I won't be able to be generous, or I'll be born in a low status, or, you know, with all sorts of suffering, so I can't help others. So first one, the power of regret, remorse. Secondly, the power of making a resolution not to do the action again. Making a very strong intention not to do the action again. Here, there's a lot to be said, because one might think, okay, I'm never going to lie again. You know, you might think there's some things you can, just by the force of your will, you know, but when karma comes up, you know, it's going to be hard to do. So it's almost to make that kind of promise becomes it's a possible lie. Better to say, for the next 10 minutes, I'm not going to lie. You know, and you keep on expanding that, you know. It's still, some lamas say, even to make the strong intention, I'm never going to lie, I'm never going to kill again, even though that's maybe not totally skillful, still, even if you've lied, if you recognize that, you know, when you broke that, you make a new intention, shorter length, more reasonable, you know. That's reminding me of some song that I remember when I was in India. I can't remember who was. Who sang it? I'm never going to fall in love again. Who is it? Yeah, so sort of, you know, thinking, you know, oh, this has been such a hassle. You know, love. I'm never going to fall in love again. So I'm like, probably you'll fall in love again, even if you make that kind of statement, right? Okay. So that particular force, the intention not to do it again, that helps to cut off the continuity of that behavior, the habitual results of karma. You know, if you've killed in the past, even after you're born in the hell realms or lower realms, you yourself are killed or your medicine doesn't work on you, you're born in a place that's very dangerous, all these different kinds of effects. The worst effect of killing is the habitual result of killing. That is, you have the habit energy of killing again in the future. You see some little children sometimes that are happy to kill bugs or hurt animals at very young age. Sort of the habit energy from past lives. To cut the habit energy of these negative actions, that's why the Buddha gave the vows of pratimoksha. You know? You know what those vows are? Basically, the seven actions of body and speech, negative actions of body and speech, not to kill, steal, engage in sexual misconduct, but in more strict, not to lie, you know, cause divisive speech, not to use harsh words, you know, not to speak idly and so forth. How can you cut the continuity of these actions? You can make a resolution not to do it, but if you make it in the presence of the Buddha as a vow, that can that has more power in your mind rather than like a New Year's resolution not to smoke. Oh, this year I'm not going to eat any more durian. You know, I don't know if you'd, maybe none of you would make that vow. Right? It's too good, right? So the first regret, the second making a strong determination not to do the action again, and even going to the extent of taking vows, the lay vows, not to kill, steal, lie, and so forth, that can be very, very powerful to cut off that habitual result. Third, and this is not necessarily in this order, it's just what in one particular order, is to compensate for the negative actions that you've created, to create a remedy for them. That is to say, you might say all of these are remedies, but say, for instance, if you've stolen and you've already regretted that, you know, you've cheated on your income tax, you've stolen or whatever, and you've made an intention, you know, strong determination, I'm not going to steal again, I'm going to really watch, you know, this is a negative action. But still, when that karma ripens in the future, it may still have some potency. So what you can do is you can create some virtuous karma as a remedy to that. So in the future, say for instance, you might make generosity now in compensation for the act of stealing. You might make offerings to the Buddhas and do virtuous actions in compensation for that. So that in the future, if you were born and some of that karmic residue is still there, maybe you were born poor, your things are stolen, maybe your wallet is stolen, but because of having made some virtuous karma to compensate for that, maybe someone brings back your wallet and say, oh, look it, I found it on the bus. You know, or maybe you lost it, you thought it was stolen, so... There are a multitude of positive things you can do in compensation, such as meditating, reciting the sutras, reciting the Heart Sutra, meditating, developing, you know, virtuous thoughts and creating virtuous karma. It's called the power of the remedy. In the case of things like Vajrasattva, have you ever heard of Vajrasattva purification? In the Vajrasattva purification, the recitation of the mantra and the visualization of light and nectar and so forth, those are called the power of the remedy. You have to have already, at the beginning of the sadhana, the Vajrasattva, you try to develop regret for the negative actions. That's why you're engaging in this. You're, oh, wow, I created this negative karma. I want to purify it. Feeling regret. Intention not to do again comes at the end of the sadhana, after you've felt the purification. Vajrasattva tells you, now you're purified. You think, I'm not going to do this again in the future. The remedy is the actual recitation of the mantra, virtuous action, and the visualization of the nectar and light coming. When you recite the names of the 35 Buddhas, confession Buddhas, the recitation of their names is the power of the remedy. You're doing this, you're trying to do this remedial action to help to compensate for the negative actions you've created. And the last of the forces is what's called the force of reliance. So one of the great Tibetan lamas say, one explanation of this, in the same way that when you fall on the ground, and is now my 74th year, you know, always thought, if I fall down, I might not be able to get up. To get up, you have to depend, you have to rely on the ground. You know, you put your hands down and get up, right? So in the same way, when you create a downfall, negative action, there's two kinds of fields, you could say, that you create negative actions with respect to sentient beings and the community of the Holy Dharma. So with respect to the Holy Dharma, the way that you can rely on the Holy Dharma is to take refuge, the community of Holy Dharma, the Buddha Dharma and Sangha. So one part of the power of reliance is taking refuge. With respect to sentient beings, you've created negative karma with respect to them. You have to rely on them to fully purify that. What's the perfect way of relying on sentient beings? Is by generating bodhicitta, the motivation that's completely the opposite of the negative thoughts that you had when you created these negative actions. So that's why at the beginning of the different practices, we take refuge in bodhicitta. Right there, if you're doing the practice as a form of purification, that itself acts as the power of reliance, refuge in bodhicitta, taking really heartfelt refuge, really relying on the Dharma jewel, the Buddha who taught it and the community of Sangha that helped you to take that medicine, and having a heartfelt sense of bodhicitta, and feeling regret, intending not to do the action again and again, having a motivation not to do it again, and doing some remedial action so when we talk, have you ever heard of striped karma? Sometimes karma we create now, you give to the hospital fundraiser, but you do so you see your name on the list. So you create some virtue by force of giving, and maybe because of virtue, you know, it's a worthy object, the hospital or the Dharma Center or something. But because it's mixed with worldly motivation, the karma is not all white. It's kind of like a rope. You know, sometimes you see a rope of black and white that are twisted together. So they say like striped. It almost looks like stripes on it, right? So like that. Remedial action can be thought of you creating what was originally a negative black rope. You've put some white stripe in it so that when it does ripen, there may be some amelioration, some lessening of the negative, final negative effect. If you apply all four opponent forces again and again, there is no negative karma that cannot be purified. And we know from our meditation, when we were meditating on the clear light nature of the mind, we start to get a feeling the delusions are not of the very nature of the mind. They can be removed. How can they be removed? You have to understand more about emptiness to know that they can be removed, because their genesis comes about because of a belief in an ego identity that doesn't really exist, an inherently existent I. When you realize that doesn't exist, it cuts off the life force of the delusions. So not only are they not only are they temporarily removable from the mind when you meditate on the clear nature, but they can be ultimately removed as you understand emptiness. You know that. So that is a good reason, you know, reasoning to apply yourself in purification, because you know that they can be removed from the mind. So these actions, these four opponent forces, do have efficacy, great power to do it. They're called the four opponent forces. Okay? Does that help? Thank you. Yes.
Say when something bad, negative, or misfortune happened to us.
Some Singapore accents like. All right. I'm having you, so okay. Speak a little more slowly so I can...
Okay. When something bad, negative, or misfortune happened to us or say to others, by the definition of karma, the understanding is that this is because of our negative karma ripening,
right,
due to some action that we intentionally acted earlier in our life or in one of our previous lives.
Right.
Is that right?
Okay. I believe so, yeah. If something bad happens to others, it's not something we did in our previous life, something they did in their previous life. Right.
But what if this something bad that happened to us or to others, right, is, for example, happened to us, is we are the victims of a crime.
Victim of some crime.
Say, a robbery crime, where not only are we beaten up, we are also robbed of our money. So can it be said that this is due to our negative karma, something that we did similarly in one of our previous life, that we have robbed somebody, or we have inflicted violence on somebody. And if that's the case, does it mean that the robber who
Before you add more and more layers. So I said first, yes, you can assume that we created some negative karma in the past. And when you want to do purification, so I'll let you continue the question, but just so that, so like sometimes you say, you might think sometimes, I don't have anything to purify. I never did anything bad this life. But if your things are stolen, if you've ever been abused, if you've lost things, you know, there's no way I can experience this unless I created the karma. So in the past, I created that. And I did so with some negative, you know, self-cherishing mind. And so that's an object of purification. Even you don't remember what you did in the past, by seeing the consequences now, you can infer, you have a firm certainty that you created negative karma in the past, and so then you can feel regret about that to purify whatever remains of that negative karma and other negative karma like that. You can infer that you've killed in the past, that you've lied and stolen in the past. Okay, so that's, so one would say from a Buddhist point of view, you can infer for sure that you created that action. Then?
Then if that's the case, right, does it mean that the robber who robbed me, he could be my victim in my previous life, or he could not necessarily be my victim in my previous life?
He won't. He or she. Come on, it could be woman.
It could be.
I mean, I have to be fair. We're gonna give women their justified high. But also they could be. They're just teasing. It wouldn't necessarily be the same person that stole from, but there would be some karmic connection with that person. It might be someone that you'd stolen from in some lifetime in the past, but the main karma that's ripening is from some other act of stealing. But there's some karmic connection with that person. Same way right now. The fact that we are all here together, listening, talking about the Dharma, thinking about it, you might think, it's just random, you know, this guy's come, American guy came. There's no way that we could be here together now unless we created the karma in the past. We all are Dharma brothers and sisters. There's no way that this could happen unless we created the karma in the past. So the same way the fellow or woman who's stolen from you, there's no way that you could have that connection unless there was some discord in the past. It doesn't necessarily have to be that particular act of stealing, that they were the one you stole from in the past, but you definitely would have stolen from them sometime in the past, and there's some kind of negative action. Okay, so then?
But if that's the case, right, does it mean that this robber in this life, due to he or she having been some recipient of some negative action from me in one of the previous lives, so in this life when he did something bad to me, does it mean that he will not incur any negative karma? Does it mean that he will not incur any negative karma in this life? Because it is due to my previous action on him or her.
They still create negative karma. You might think, they deserved to steal from me because I stole from them in the past. Now it's all finished, right? Like when you're kids, you stole from your brother. Now your sister stole from you. Now it's all even. So forget about it. It's not like that. That might work in the family, you know. You say, okay, you know, it's over. She slapped you, you slapped her back. Stop fighting. You know? It's not like that. So, in fact, it's an object of your compassion. Because, you know, the fact that this person is creating this negative karma that they will experience the results of in the future, they will have, maybe they'll be born in the lower realms. Among us, other things, they will have their possessions stolen. Their crops will be not as vibrant. You know, there'll be years when their crops don't grow as a result of their stealing from me now. If I had not stolen in the past, they would not be stealing from me now. So in a sense, I'm responsible for is a cooperative condition for them creating that negative karma. Of course, they were doing it out of their own delusion, their own, attachment or avarice or something. But I'm a cooperative condition. So to feel some responsibility and so then to feel compassion for them. it's not over. They're going to experience suffering in the future. Does that exhaust your question? Okay, good. So there was different parts. It was good to go. So it's just a little after 9:30. This is the time the class ends. So I'm sorry. If you have some more question, I'll stay a little bit afterwards if you want to stay. But I don't want to keep people from getting on the... I know some of you have traveled by, what is it called? BMW? You know BMW? Bus, MRT, and walking, right? So you have to get to the MRT or the bus. So let's do a final dedication. See if you can recall the clear light nature of the mind that we have been meditating on for the last 2 months. Some of us have. Some of you are just new to it. Not just a remembering consciousness, but to try to merge that with your experience right now, the clarity, to recall that clarity, to see it, to recall the emptiness of the self, selflessness, even the emptiness of the mind. To think with a good motivation at the beginning, I've definitely created some virtuous karma this evening. Thinking that karma and all the virtuous karma I've created in the past, that I will create in the future, let me dedicate it to this goal of my distant aim of achieving enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings. Whatever way these karmic seeds ripen, may they become the cause of my continued spiritual development, year by year, life by life. May I eliminate the faults from my mind, my behavior, so I don't harm others or myself. May I develop all the good qualities to, starting with compassion and empathy for others, and then reaching out and working for their welfare, just as I work for my own welfare, practicing the Bodhisattva deeds, having the fortune as a result of these merits to encounter a secret mantra, the Vajrayana. Due to these merits, may I quickly achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And if you can seal that dedication with a meditation on the emptiness of the three spheres, meaning the karma, the act of dedication, the karmic seeds we're dedicating, the act of dedication, and the goals we're dedicating to, all those three spheres, so to speak, are empty of inherent existence. They appear to us as inherently existent. They function, but they are empty of inherent existence. Okay, thank you very much. So thanks for your attendance, your good minds, your good hearts, and coming. I've enjoyed talking these last 2 months, and hopefully we'll meet again sometime. We definitely, if not this lifetime, a future. But have a good heart. I may be that shaggy little dog down at your feet that's lapping at your feet in the future. So you may say. I might pee on you. If I pee on you, be patient. But, you know, thank you very much. Take care.
Oh, sir, since it's the last teaching tonight again, Venerable George, on behalf of Amitabha Buddhist Center and all the members here, we cannot say thank you enough.
You can.
For taking the time to travel to Singapore over the last 2 months. to deliver the precious teachings of the Buddha Dharma at so many different levels that all of us can relate to. It's something we all seem to take for granted, that in Singapore we're so fortunate to have teachings of so many teachers coming through. And really your visit to Singapore this time, I believe, has touched maybe another sector of the audience which don't normally come to the center. So that really has been very helpful in creating another outreach to another sector of the Buddhist members that don't come to the center. So we really, really thank you very much. And can we implore you again, please come back.
Thank you very much.
Next year? This year, the end of this year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, not the next year.
Yeah, we're in 2019 already. And really, really, we really thoroughly enjoyed your teachings very much. And so please, please, please do come back. And thank you very much, everybody. Let's give a round of applause to Venerable George.
Thank you. Thank you, Apshe. Have a good night. Take care.